The Grape Nation is brought to you by Wine Access. Here's a great way to discover and drink the best wines expertly curated for you. Go to wineaccess.com/grapenation for more info.
With our growing season just around the corner, we're sowing seeds of knowledge and empathy on this week's episode of Meat and Three through four unique stories.
I'm always shocked at how aggressive people are with their language. They'll have something like Japanese knotweed and they'll say, you know, these are terrible, they're foreigners, they're invasive, and you know, but they're also, you know, they're really healthy if you eat them.
We're surrounded by seeds that have already adapted to live with us, and they're actually already kind of living in the future because cities are hotter and they're more polluted and they're more fragmented, and these are the plants that can deal with that.
Tune in to Meat and Three, available wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guests are Jane Lopes and Jonathan Ross. We'll talk to Jane and John about the wines of Australia, micro wines, and legend. We'll taste an Australian cab and a Cinzo for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Jane Lopes has graced our microphones a few times to discuss sexual harassment in the wine industry, multiple issues at the Quartermaster Sommeliers, and more importantly, her life through her book, Vignette, or just as important. Jonathan Ross is a master sommelier. He worked as head somm at 11 Madison Park before following Jane to Australia to work with the Rockpool Group. While in Australia, John bought a few grapes to make wine. This was the beginning of micro wines. Jane and John, who are married, moved back to the States to start Legend Imports, focusing on the wines of Australia. Welcome to the Grape Nation, Jane and John.
Thanks for
having me. Jane, welcome back. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, I'm excited about this because I'm excited about what you guys are doing, and I, you know, want to get into it. We're talking to you guys remotely via the Zencastr app. Where are you guys right now?
We're in Los Angeles right now.
Which is where you moved and are living?
No.
No. Okay. Don't make this long. Go ahead.
Well, the short story is we're not really living anywhere. We're on the road. Most of our stuff is in storage.
Okay.
Really in Australia, and we inherited a car from John's grandfather, and we're just on the road.
We've been driving around since the end of March, and that's what we'll keep doing for the rest of this year.
Hey, why not? You know, you got to be on the road to sell this stuff. Now, John, Jane's been on the show a couple times, like I said, you know, discussing some very important and great stuff. This is your first time. Give me a very quick chronology of your journey in life and wine, you know, when you got into the biz, how that progressed, and how you got to where you are today, which is your wine and the import company.
Yeah, I grew up in Central Jersey. My parents are both public educators and retired, and I, after high school, studied sports medicine and architecture and enjoyed working in restaurants more than going to school. So stopped going to school and just focused on working in restaurants, and then decided to get a hospitality management degree from a local college. Moved into New York when I was 24, having worked at some pretty inspirational restaurants for me at the time in New Jersey, in particular Stage Left in New Brunswick, left a pretty indelible mark on me. In New York, I worked at a variety of restaurants. I worked for Michael Psellakis and Donatella Arpaia at Anthos and Miadona. I worked at Porterhouse with Michael LaMonaco, ended up as the AGM at Oceana at the Lovanos Group, and then went on to work at 11 Madison Park for a little over 5 years. And the last two and a bit were as the head somm. And all through that, kind of just engaging with wine and going through formal education and, you know, hands-on education and so on. And, you know, towards the end of my time at EMP, realizing it was kind of time to do something different, but didn't know exactly what that was. And fortuitously, Jane got offered a job in Australia where I could go and really work wherever I want and do whatever I wanted. So we just jumped and went. And I had worked Harvest a little bit here and there in the U.S. And then kind of hooked up with, became pretty good friends with Mac Forbes while down there, and spent a good 4 weeks with him straight during the 2018 Harvest, and really just kind of had so many aha moments and realized that my entire career and relationship with wine was from a finished product, you know, endpoint user point of view. And there's just so much more that goes on before that. And realized that I had never worked in the wine industry. I only ever worked in the hospitality industry. And Australia was a pretty open, accepting, and encouraging place for, you know, for new people. So I kind of just, you know, dove in and became friends with another winemaker who was at an estate called Bannockburn, which is kind of right across the street from the Farr family in Geelong, and really kind of the original estate in that area. And bought some Syrah grapes that were planted in the 80s on some pretty interesting limestone soils, and you know, just paid some equipment use fees and made the wine there under the watchful eye of someone who wasn't going to touch it as long as I wasn't going to screw anything up. And I learned that if you don't get fancy, wine kind of takes care of itself as it goes through the fermentation process. It's the growing process that's the difficult part. And from there, kind of, you know, off to the races and making a few different things and adding to the brand, but also just really becoming fully curious and seeking more of those aha moments from wine outside of the point of view of restaurants and retail and that finished product. And I think early on in Australia, Jane and I realized that we were going to bring Australia back with us when we returned to the US. We started looking at Legend probably within 6 months of being there, originally trying to start it while we were there, but knew that it was us that had to tell the story for it to be successful. Right. And here we are today, telling the story.
Let me ask you something. Let me ask you two things, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. In there, you got your master sommelier. Just tell me, when did you get the MS? A few years ago?
Yeah, so I had gone through everything and passed two of the three sections all while living in the U.S. And the year right. I moved to Australia in 2017, I flew back from Australia to take tasting in 2017 in October, and passed. And that was when I passed. So I was working and living in Australia. And honestly, the first couple of years of me, you know, being an MS, I really didn't engage with the U.S. community too much.
Right. You were away.
I was over abroad. I taught all of my teaching, you know, under that banner, experiences in Australia. I did do a bit of work for GuildSomm, you know, maintaining the compendium, right. Fact checking articles, things like that as a way to kind of stay in touch. But that was about it.
Was it the typical, you know, you spent 3, 4, 5 years of intensive time, you know, during the day through the years to prepare for that?
Yeah, I mean,
it was time consuming and it's expensive, right?
It's time consuming and expensive. And, you know, when I was at 11 Madison, most of my time there was, you know, waking up early and studying for a few hours before going into work,
tasting.
And then tasting as well. And, you know, we hosted the tasting group at EMP for a long time. It was a group that we hosted at Oceana for a bit as well. And it was a group right. that actually broke out of a iFiori group that Risto was leading. And really right. the most valuable part of that, and I think for Jane as well, is this community network of tasting groups that we were all a part of for so long.
The people. Totally. All right, so I don't want to spend a ton of time on this because I really want to move on to the fun and important stuff. But, and Jane and I know this as well as anyone, her way more than me. We know that the court has gone through a bunch of changes for some very, you know, obvious reasons. And I want your take on it because, you know, I got Jane's. Is it too little too late, or are the prospects there for a reasonable future for the court? I mean, where's your head on this?
My head on this is kind of back to the people that we just, you know, mentioned. The greatest asset of a group of wine professionals is the people. And you don't need this, an umbrella symbol organization, a mechanism to package these people in. And all of that can change as long as the group of people are intact and pushing forward, and it can be under the umbrella of the court. It can be a different organization, whatever it is. And I've realized, and we've realized, you don't need the court to be a mentor, to be a leader, to learn, to grow. It is not something that I think we've, you know, I was on a call a little while ago and Dylan Proctor said it best. The CMS has been telling us that they're the authority for a very long time. And it shouldn't be about them being the authority. It should be about a group of people that want to give back and mentor and teach and make the industry better. And, you know, I think that for me personally, the CMS has a lot to prove and a lot to do before I ever, you know, beat their drum again as loud as I can and you know, spread the gospel. But I think as far as being the individual that I think that I wanted to be once I passed, you don't need the CMS to do that.
I totally agree. You know, I think as a matter of fact, your willingness, you know, to do that in the community that existed probably was held back, you know, by being in the court. You know, you could do whatever you want, you know, and have the same, you know, effect. I agree with that. Let's move on because I don't want to make the show about that. I want to talk to you a little about Australia and Australian wines. And then, you know, I want to get deep into your stuff. And it'll be a good chance for us to taste our first wine. But tell me if I'm wrong on this. Australian wines were very popular a few years ago, and I don't know what that few was, 5, 10, 15, maybe even the early 2000s. You know, they made a big impression with the big, bold Syrahs. It was almost like that Napa Cab thing. You know, everybody loved Napa Cabs because they were big and bold, and I think that's how they looked at Australia. And again, correct me when I'm done, everything seemed to go out of favor. You didn't see those wines. You didn't see much Australian wines. And now you're seeing a lot of good things coming out of Australia, the wines, the people, things like you guys. Is that a fair assessment of, you know, what has gone on?
Yeah. I would say it is. I early to mid 2000s, I think is, and even late 90s.
Yeah, it's really a 30-year time span when you look at this kind of ebb and flow of Australian wine's popularity.
And you're right. It came in with kind of the big, bold Barossa Shiraz that, you know, was able to command a fair amount of money. And then I think a few things happened. I think, you know, the currency exchange got really poor in terms of bringing Australian wine to the U.S. And so, you know, the wines got even more expensive and, you know, I don't think Australia at that time was doing a good job of kind of building up brand Australia as a whole. And it was really just this one style.
It was a marketing problem at some point.
Yeah, I would say. I think it's a marketing problem in some respect.
I think Jane always kind of likens it to a little bit of a house palate or cellar palate, and the people in charge of marketing these wines abroad. And not to speak to, you know, there's incredible people that are on the ground today, Mark Davidson, Christy Frank that are running education for Wine Australia and have done a great job. But as a whole, to market Australian wine to American buyers and sommeliers and consumers with an Australian sensibility of what's great doesn't necessarily translate, because every group of people is attracted to different things in a wine and different attributes. And there was a cellar palate where what people really believed to be great in Australia, they just assumed that that was also going to be considered great in the US. And that doesn't hold true for really any wine producing country.
Yeah. And I think it also wasn't the era of the Somme, you know, it was still, you know, so dominated by retail buyers and what they liked, and more importantly, what they could sell. And I think when kind of the era of the Somme entered and everyone was, you know, really curious about all the, you know, obscure wine regions and, you know, European wine really kind of became, first and foremost in the United States, Australia kind of lost out in that. And then Yellowtail did not help either, because Australia became seen as sort of this bulk wine producing country. Right.
They got a bad rap from that.
Yeah, exactly.
Then you and I agreed that, you know, Syrah was king and that's what people thought. Is there now an interest in a diversity of grapes? You know, I'm not assuming. I know more artisanal, smaller wineries are making wine, and that's what you guys are doing. But even before you and with you, is that stuff starting to come to the U.S.?
Totally, and I think, you know, it's a combination of a few things. It's the idea that Australia is not. And it's funny, we see this as low-hanging fruit when we talk about where Australian wine can go. When you talk about Australian wine, you see it listed on portfolios or in wine lists. It's just listed as Australia, and there's no sub-regionality or regionality. And there are places in Australia where Syrah just would never grow. But Pinot Noir grows and Riesling grows really well. And I think it's the really kind of commitment to understanding and using those different regionality characteristics to a positive. And I was actually talking to a winemaker who's in the Great Southern in Western Australia not too long ago, and he talked about how Australia touts this idea that it's a new world and they don't have any AOCs or DOCs and they can do whatever they want. But he says that there's these social, you know, self-imposed restrictions on styles of wine and so on. And that heavy Shiraz that you're talking about is exactly that self-imposed limitation. And in the past 10 years, Australia as a whole has really taken that limitation off.
And this is not to say that, honestly, that we have anything against that style. And I think that, you know, the rich Barossa Shiraz is a really beautiful, unique thing that Australia does. And we have, you know, some of those styles in our portfolio as well. I think it's just about showing, yeah, a more complete picture of what Australia is doing on, you know, every end of the spectrum.
So good segue, Jane. I asked if you would be kind to send a couple of wines to taste that are part of your portfolio. And you sent me two wines, and let's quickly talk about the first one. It's called Merit. It is a Cabernet Sauvignon. It is from Rattenbully. That's all I'm going to say. It's a 2015, so it obviously has a little bottle age, and maybe it sits in the barrels for a bit. But tell me a little about this. This is a traditional cab, it seems like.
Yeah, you know, this is a producer, Merit, that all the wines in our portfolio are wines that John and I worked with, either one of us or both of us when we were living in Australia. And so we have very personal relationships to these wines. You know, I met Colleen Miller, who's one of the proprietors of Merit. She came and tasted with me when I was working at Attica in Australia. And, you know, I was struck by the quality of the wines and just, you know, her and her husband, Mike, were just really, going about things in a different way, and also really championing a region that had yet to be sort of really recognized in Australia, Ratanbully. So Ratanbully is just north of Coonawarra, and Coonawarra is at least much more famous in Australia and marginally more famous in the rest of the world. But you're talking about the limestone coast, southern South Australia, right on the Victorian border. And Coonawarra is a region that's really well known for its Cabernet Sauvignon. And Ratanbully is basically just an extension of this region, a little bit higher elevation, but also a little bit warmer, so less frost risk. So really a beneficial region, and a region that that people have been buying grapes from for you know, decades, really recognizing the quality and the value that this region represents, in contrast to Coonawarra, which is a fairly expensive region. So,
right. I'm looking at this wine, and it's a very deep, dark, brooding wine, typical Cab. On the nose, you know, you have that black fruit. I mean, what else can you tell me about, you know, this wine? I pick up some vegetal on the nose, which I like, you know.
Yeah, so green. I think it's, you know, they talk about, so the Marriott started as grape growers, and they've been selling grapes off for 15 years to different people. And this 2015 is their first vintage of making their wines. So they talk about how they're picking their grapes 2 weeks earlier than a lot of the grapes they're selling. So you do get more of those savory characteristics. But, you know, this is still a 14% alcohol wine. It's not shy, it's not lean. And really what we love about it is it does kind of really bridge the qualities that we appreciate in, you know, quote unquote, old world wine, you know, kind of a more Bordeaux style, and the qualities that you traditionally get in new world wine, that kind of riper fruit quality. So I think it kind of has best of both worlds, and you get nice ripeness of fruit, but also really good structure, both acidity and tannin. And as you identified, kind of those really nice savory notes.
Yeah. What will this be available in the States? Is it available? When and approximate cost?
Yeah, it is. It is currently in the States. It's in a few different markets, namely, I believe, New York and Illinois right now.
And Vermont.
And New Jersey. And they right now, there's essentially two tiers. So the Cabernet and Merlot, that's at the 2015s that are in the market now, retail, I think right at 60?
60, 65.
So, and then there's another range. It's a little bit younger and under screw cap. That's $29 retail.
That, to me, this is a good value for that. I will post the wines and any follow-up information, you know, as we post social. You started to get into this, but I want you to finish it, because I think when people look at Australia, they know Australia makes wines. They see this country sort of the shape of the U.S., but they have no idea where the wine is made. You know, so when you look at like an Italy or a France, these countries have dozens and dozens of winemaking regions, literally, you know, all different climates and everything. In Australia, most of the wines are made, you know, in the south and the east. Just tell me about, you know, that's the regions that you discussed, you know, are in that area. And just tell me about everything else. And you guys worked in Melbourne, which is, you know, not far. It would be like a San Francisco to Napa type thing. Just let people visualize where the wine is in that country.
Yeah. So if it really is in that southeast corner. And I think when, you know, we were in Melbourne, which is the southern eastern city, kind of about, you know, a 45-minute plane flight north, you know, to Tasmania. So really in that southeastern corner. To give you an idea, Sydney is about a one-hour flight north, but in general, very much the southern half of the country. And it's all along that kind of southeastern coast, the state of Victoria, quite small, is full of wine regions. And then New South Wales, where Sydney is, has, it's really kind of its southeastern corner of that is wine region. And then South Australia, which, like you said, it's about a 9-hour drive from Melbourne to Adelaide along the Great Ocean Road. So very much like driving from San Fran to LA. And all of those wine regions, the majority are centered along the southern coast where Adelaide is, the city. These wines that where Jane mentioned, the Limestone Coast, is a little bit further south and east of Adelaide, and actually is inland, but at one time was the southern coast of Australia, and is very much all limestone with some clay soils over top. South Australia, as an example, is 50% desert. And then there's a little bit of corner in the very far southwestern portion of the country near Margaret River and south of Perth, and then, of course, Tasmania.
So is limestone predominant, and there's a diversity of terroirs and soils, or there's a ton of different stuff?
There's a ton of different stuff. Australia is home to the oldest known earth-made substance, mapped at about 4.5 billion years old, and it's deposited in sedimentary soils in Western Australia. In general, the whole southeastern corner, where the Great Dividing Range is, there's a lot of extinct volcanoes and volcanic activity. Most of Tasmania is covered with a really large volcanic intrusion. But all of these are quite old. So soils ranging from, 400 to 600 million years old, with then some much older soils that have been there. And again, so if we think about Margaret River, the formations there are about 1.5 billion years old. Central Victoria, you're about 500 million years old. And it ranges from volcanic soil in origin, really hard old sedimentary soils of mudstone and shale and ironstone. There's certainly a lot of limestone around the coastal areas, but many have been covered with more recent volcanic intrusions. There's over 80 different identified GIs across the country, all of different altitudes and climate and soil and geology. It is extremely diverse. And it's one of those things where, you could have a 400 bottle wine list that's all French wine and really cover every style and execute a 20 course tasting menu with a different wine all from France. It is absolutely not even doable. It's easily done and exciting to do the same with Australian wine.
Yeah, I would think so. So you mentioned climate is diverse too. I mean, you have coastal, inland, hot, cool, everything, right?
Totally.
Depending where.
Yeah. Cold enough for really crisp, sparkling wines. We have a couple in our portfolio. Moderate enough for really gentle Pinot. We actually find places like the Yarra Valley and Tasmania, when you look at climate, they're actually about as – climate is more akin to Oregon or even warmer parts of Burgundy. The thing is, Australia's got a ton of sunshine. So it's a place that can be as cold as, like in parts of Tasmania, they're colder than Dijon, but they've got about 40% more sunshine hours on the year, which is a really wonderful kind of point of difference and tension between old world wines and wines, where you have similar climate, just so much more, fruit flavor.
Right. When you look at places like the Jura and the Loire, there's a pretty good track record and history of organics, even biodynamics, low intervention winemaking. Has that been going on there? Has it switched to that? Because if you look at Napa, they're not doing anything. And if you look at other, what's sort of the organics, history track record there?
Yeah, I mean, Australia has a great track record there. I think because Australia is kind of the pioneers of a lot of viticultural technology, there's this idea that goes hand in hand with a lot of additives in the vineyard, but it's actually quite the opposite. It's a pretty highly regulated country, and there's not, you know, there just isn't a wide usage of these kind of really nasty sort of additives. So even people who are farming, let's call it conventionally, you know, it's pretty mild, and there is a lot of research that Wine Australia, as well as individuals, have been doing to, you know, use things, you know, systemics in the vineyard that are have the least amount of impact on the soils, you know. And but beyond that, you know, there is a lot of producers who have converted to organics, a lot of producers who are biodynamic. It's definitely a really strong movement in Australia. And I think
is the climate conducive to that? You know, is it drier and not as wet? Like in Oregon, you know, they worry about powdery mildew. Is it a little easier to deal with that stuff there because it doesn't exist as much?
Yeah, in a variety of ways. You've got, you know, rather than having too much moisture, having too little moisture is more the problem. So disease pressures are low. Australia has become very good at recapturing and reclaiming water. So we talk about irrigation as this dirty, negative thing, but no one's, you know, hooking up to the sewer system and pumping, you know, reserved water. It's catchment dams and rainwater collections and filtered, you know, and recycled gray water. And most people who are irrigating, if not all, really aren't purchasing water from the town. They are going about it in a renewable way. You know, when it comes to organics and biodynamics, those certifications are managed by an organization in Australia called, it's NASA, and National Association for Sustainable Agriculture Australia. And rather than just doing an organic certification, they also do a biodynamic certification. Them along with Demeter are present in the country, and there's a lot of people that are really kind of driven by those, by that organization. It's been around since the 70s, so those certifications have been in play for quite some time. And when it comes to renewable energy and resources, you know, for an example, in November, Tasmania became 100% reliable on renewable energy, which is a pretty incredible feat for, you know, they're in a place that makes it a little easier. But it's an incredible feat regardless.
Still, it's a commitment.
Totally. And it's a commitment that Australia as a whole has made for a while.
Well, and yeah, and a lot of that, you know, a technology that I spoke of really arose to address irrigation. You know, if you think about like deficit irrigation and stuff like that, you know, yes, they're beneficial for the quality of the vineyards, but they're also in large part to save water. And you know, I think that a lot of times we look at technology as kind of, you know, the antithesis to this, like, you know, old traditional way of making wine. But a lot of it really is, you know, doing some fantastic things towards natural resource management.
Right. Guys, we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to get specifically into your wines and, you know, what you're doing at Legend. And we're going to taste the micro for the weekly wine sip. You're listening to the Janie and Johnny Show on the Grape Nation. I'm Sam Ben Ruby. We will be right back. It's time to make a move on those wines you've been thinking about. Wine Access makes it so easy for everyone to order the most delicious wines from around the world. If you're just starting out or adding to the collection, Wine Access's team of experts taste over 20,000 bottles annually, curating everything from renowned to under-the-radar winemakers. Here's a few great suggestions. The 2018 Arietta Quartet Red and the Giving Kitchen Cab Sauv, both from Napa Valley. Check them out. You'll also learn about each wine you buy because Wine Access tells you the story behind the wines, helping you understand and appreciate what makes each bottle special. Check out Wine Access today to find your new favorite bottle. Here's an exclusive offer just for the Grape Nation listeners. 20% off your first order. But to get this offer, visit our special URL, wineaccess.com/grapenation. That's wineaccess.com/grapenation for your 20% off discount on your first order. You can't go wrong with any bottle, because if any wine fails to impress, Wine Access will credit the bottle. No questions asked. Go to wineaccess.com/grapenation. All right, we're back. We're back with my guests, Jane Lopes and Jonathan Ross. Jane and John launched a new company called Legend, where they're importing wines from Australia into the U.S. John is making wines called Micro. And I want to talk about this. The obvious question is, you know, when and how did the idea of starting this company come about?
You're talking about Legend, correct?
Or Micro.
Legend, yeah. Cool. Yeah, no, let's talk Legend.
Yeah.
We'll talk Micro towards the end.
Good. Yeah, we were in Australia. You know, I was working for, I think I had actually, it was just after I passed. It was probably the end of 2017. We kind of started messing around with the idea of bringing Australian wine back to the U.S. And it was something that we realized was long overdue. We likened it to as if 95% of Italian wine wasn't present in the U.S. And that included, you know, incredibly singular producers and regions alike. And we started looking at figuring out how to do it while we were in Australia and, you know, finding someone in Australia, in the U.S. maybe to partner with, and, you know, going through business plans. And we realized we needed to be stateside to do it. So the kind of following 2 years was building business plans, talking to potential investors, and really kind of gearing up and collecting producers and so on. And we just knew that, you know, going to Australia, we first said, we have no idea what we're going to do when we get back. So we have no plan beyond Australia. And soon after, Australia gave us a plan for when we got back. So it was kind of, you know, fortuitous happenstance in that regard. But
right. I'm curious about something. As big as Australia is, and as popular as the wines were, and, you know, now again are, is there underrepresentation in the States? Are there a lot of good winemakers that don't have deals here, or a big chunk of the good wines are here?
We think there's still a lot to be represented. Right. I think it's there's regions where maybe, whether it's a historical producer that's been around for a long time, whether it's really just the very best of the best producers that aren't here. There's a few of them. And,
right.
You know, there's producers that have been around for 15, 20 years that are doing amazing things that have never been here. So there really is a lack of representation, but it's also a lack of real just understanding and appreciation.
Right. Explain. So you're the importer. Your goal is to bring the wines from this country to the United States for the market. How does the, and I know the answer, but I want you to tell, you know, the listeners, how does the wine, as an importer, how do you get it throughout the country? You have to set up arrangements in each market as the importer and look for a distributor?
Correct. So, you know,
that's a big part of your business plan right now, getting
exactly
all that together,
so,
right?
You know, we originally had kind of thought maybe we self-distribute and kind of have control of every step in the process. But we realized as we did more research and started setting things up that really, you know, being responsible for distribution would give us less time to do the things that we were really passionate about and that we felt were really important to build, you know, to build brand Australia and the United States, like, you know, like outreach and education.
Right.
And so
you would be caught up in the business.
Exactly.
We also recognize from being buyers that no one wants to work with a new distributor,
especially a global pandemic
that's focused just on Australian wine. So it'd be a lot easier if our portfolio was within a larger distributor, and there were, you know, shared efforts. We brought things to the table. Distributors bring things to the table, and it's just a better, you know, all around effort that proves to be more successful.
That makes sense. I mean, you guys know what kind of time you have on the job to meet people and talk about it. Now, there's something very important going on with your company, you know, important to me, but obviously, you know, you're building the business around it. And you founded the company based on a set of values called a statement of values. Just tell me a little about this, because this is a very socially, you know, conscious company. Not big, but, you know, everybody should be thinking about it or doing it at any size. So tell me what this statement of values is or are.
Yeah, well, you know, I think coming back to the United States from Australia in March of last year was kind of a big wake-up call for both of us. You know, Australia has definitely some of its own problems, but it is in general a pretty...
it's a place that doesn't necessarily leave its own behind as much as the US does. And both places certainly do. But, you know, we kind of, and I think for a while, and we felt this way from some of the business owners we interacted with or worked for in Australia, but also have seen it in the US as well. And I think back to my time at Stage Left in New Jersey, just the idea of employing someone or having a business, it goes beyond financials. And for us, we don't employ anyone right now. We've yet to even pay ourselves. But
we're exploiting our own labor.
But the idea, like, we see ourselves when we get to the point where we can provide a livelihood for someone, that's a really big deal. And there's a few right ways to do that. There's a lot of wrong ways to do that. And I think we want to be people that if we're going to go into business for ourselves and we start to work with other people and build relationships and so on, we kind of want to help foster the type of livelihood and interactions and relationships that we want to have and that we believe everyone should have. And I think that's kind of where it was born out of. And, you know, I mean, we always talk about Australia's, you know, labor, there's not really labor issues the way there are in the US. Everyone's paid $25 an hour minimum wage, and there's healthcare everywhere. And those are pie in the sky things in the US, but we don't want to be a business that employs people and doesn't offer some level of healthcare. We don't want to be people who pay minimum wage in the US because there are things that we don't believe provide a sustainable life in the US.
And we don't want to be representing wineries that are exploiting labor.
Well, that was my question. You will hold your partners to a same or similar set of values, right? I mean, if something is so blatantly wrong, you know, at a winery or whatever, you're done with them. I mean, so you are holding them to these
totally.
Values,
and
right?
Luckily, Australia is a place where the government holds people accountable pretty hard. It's not too difficult to get temporary work visas, so there's really little if no exploited or undocumented labor. And as I said, minimum wage is $25 an hour and everyone has health care. And wage theft in Australia is a criminal offense. People go to jail for it. There's some basic things that I think are, you know, built in. As an example, I was buying fruit and I would get a picked and unpicked fruit price. And it was always at least a $600 per ton difference, essentially saying you're paying for labor. Because it's going to cost this much money to get the fruit picked. I sell that to people that maybe buy fruit in California, and it's the first time they ever heard about the cost of picking the fruit being factored into a fruit price.
Wow. So different. That's unbelievable.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's okay if I tell people. I mean, at some point we're going to tell them if, you know, they want more information on Legend, they can go to your website, and it talks about, you know, what your portfolio is, but there's also a section with the statement of values, and it's interesting to see the depth of it and, you know, how socially conscious you are. So the statement of values is on the Legend website. Tell me a little like how the sausage is made. You know, you have a small growing portfolio of wines, I mean, you were pretty clear saying that being in the business, you were really around wine and the winemakers. So, you know, you had a pretty good Rolodex of people to approach. Is that how you put the initial portfolio together? You went to the wines that you liked, the people that you knew. You know, how'd you get the core thing going first?
Yeah, you know, we just reached out to, there's a lot of wine that we really love. And honestly, I think we could turn around tomorrow and
triple the portfolio.
Yeah, and reach out to 50 producers we'd love to work with. But, you know, we just had to be smart and strategic to represent a variety of regions and styles and price points. So we kind of put together an initial list of what we thought kind of would look like a really well-rounded portfolio. And, you know, yeah, we just reached out, and most people we had a personal relationship with already. Some people we got, you know, an introduction from their Australian distributor if we hadn't met them in person while we were in Australia. But there was,
that was only one producer.
Yeah, so almost everyone, there was already a personal connection in place. So we just reached out and said, you know, this is what we're doing, and, you know, we'd love you to be a part of it. And
these people didn't have representation in the U.S., or they weren't happy, or both?
So there's a couple, you know, scenarios. There's one producer who was represented in the U.S., prior to its current ownership. It's actually the only winery where we don't deal directly with the owner winemaker, which is Seppelsfield. They're a bit larger, but they're super historic. And they were imported by Negotiants, I think 15 years ago.
Didn't they just release this 100-year-old wine in casks or something I saw?
Yeah, so since 1978,
crazy.
They've been releasing 100-year-old wine. So they started with 1878. And they just did the 1921. So those are things, that's something that we have, you know, available.
There's old vine and there's old wine.
There's old vine. And this is both. Okay.
And also there's really nothing like this wine when you think about it. I mean, yes, you could find 100-year-old port or Madeira on the market, but none of those things have been aging in barrel for 100 years, you know,
literally. That was the barrel. Point.
And they're not always estate grown. I mean, you think about Madeira, the bottler is not the farmer. You know, this is grower 100 years in wood. It's pretty wild. And, you know, we're really excited to have them. And, you know, fortified wine was a history in Australia, the same way it was in the US, but they've got an incredible portfolio of vineyards throughout the Barossa, and we have wines from them that retail for $20 a bottle, all the way up to, you know, 1,000-year-old, 100-mil bottles of 100-year-old wine. So,
So you said you were, you know, you wanted to have a balanced portfolio, you know, which makes total sense, you know, regionally, and all of that. Were there any frustrations, you know, that you wanted more, but you had to start with less, just because you wanted to give the proper representation and you don't want to start too big of a company?
Not really. I feel like the only...
No?
Think of anything, it was the opposite. We maybe wanted less.
It was.
you did? We were... When COVID hit, we kind of realized that we were going to be doing this without any kind of serious funding, and we were just kind of going to make it happen ourselves. So we were asking for somewhat extended terms from our producers. And so, you know,
we thought they were all going to say no, and we'd be, you know,
they were all cooperative.
Yeah.
They know you, you know them. You got to take some of the benefits of a relationship.
Yeah.
Well, and that's,
you know, I mean, you've been good to a lot of these guys, I'm sure, at both restaurants. They were glad to hear from you.
Well, and that's something that we talk about, that, you know, looking back on this, you know, in normal times, we can go to work and save up money and, you know, get the capital that we used of our own savings to start this. But the currency that you earn, and I think this goes back to our statement of values, the currency that you earn by doing the right things is something that's also deposited in a bank. But you can't go back and re-earn that as easily. And I think we both recognize that we were kind of putting that on the line. Yes, we built relationships where people could trust us, but we needed to then also follow through. So we're thrilled to say that we've been paying our bills on time to our producers, and it really means a ton to us to be able to do that. And I know a lot of people in this industry don't. But you know, it's recognizing the sensitivity of that relationship and putting it as paramount.
Right. You know, when I looked on the website, one of the reasons I asked you to describe, you know, the wine growing region, so people, when they look at Australia, they realize, oh, that's where the wine is made. But it looks like that, you know, three or four regions, Tasmania, you know, is where the thick of the wine country is. And that's, you know, where most of your producers are, right? You know, in Victoria, Southern Australia, all those regions, right?
Yeah. So right now we have producers, we're bringing over producers from Victoria, South Australia, and Tasmania, which is where kind of the bulk of the wine in Australia is made. We're definitely, Western Australia is not a super significant in terms of volume, but in terms of premium wine, it absolutely is. And so we're talking to a few producers over there. We're talking to producers in New South Wales and even Queensland. So we definitely want to get kind of all those states on board, but we felt like in terms of, kind of an initial telling the story and also initial ease of logistics in terms of getting things.
It made business sense.
Yeah. That you had. That those three regions we thought were kind of the first ones we wanted to get on board.
Right. You know, my last bunch of guests, the show for February focused on West Coast winemakers. And what I realized after talking to them, Martha Steumans, Tegan Pascalak, was, you know, those guys, even I didn't talk to Dan Petrosky, but all these guys are making wines in California that are not the typical California varietals. In Australia, we talked about Shiraz, you know, being an important varietal. People are making Pinot. Is there an expansion of the varietals? Are there, you know, some funky new wines and grapes? I mean, do you have your eye on that?
Yeah. I mean,
John, you're making a Cinzeau, which is not unpopular, but I mean, people don't think of that in Australia.
Cinzeau was in Australia just as, you know, I mean, like, but, you know, like, give you an idea. I was working when I was at the Rockpool Group, we had an Italian restaurant, and I was working the floor one night and someone asked me for a Nebbiolo, and I turned to the Barolo page and they're like, no, Nebbiolo's Australian. Italian grapes are abundant and thriving in Australia. And for Jane and I think we would firmly say that outside of Italy, there's no larger presence of Italian varieties, nor really is any other country doing them as well.
So
you're going to go ahead.
I think we have one producer, Chalmers, who focuses pretty much exclusively on Italian grapes. And the way they look at it is they're making Australian wine. You know, Italian grapes just really work with where their vineyards are. And Italian grapes are just as international as Pinot Noir and Chardonnay and Cabernet, you know?
For Australia.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Interesting. So when the rubber hits the road, you got to get the wines in restaurants and you got to get the wines on retail shelves. And you guys are now experiencing both sides of it. What's the pitch? You know, John, you're a busy guy at 11 Madison. You know, you're a busy guy at Rockpool. Janie, you worked at some, you know, pretty killer places. Guy walks in. You know, why should they buy these wines? I mean, here's an opportunity to, you know, give the pitch. I know it. I get it. I'm sold. But, you know, tell me why this is important and, you know, why I should make room for this.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we talk about a lot. Why Australia? And, you know, I think it's things that we've already touched on. You can feel very confident in the labor practices that, you know, the bottle of wine that you're buying, no labor was exploited to get that wine in your glass.
And farming practices.
And farming practices as well are very good across the board.
I think the story is important to consumers now, whether they're, you know, owners of restaurants, bars, or the actual consumer. So that's a good point. Go ahead.
Yeah. I mean, I think in general for consumers, there's, you know, ease of packaging. Wines are in general varietally labeled. They come under screw cap, which I think consumers are coming around to in a major way, as seeing as a very easy and reliable closure. You know, the design sensibilities tend to be really good, which I think is important when retailers are looking how a wine will do on their shelves. You know, for us, it's kind of this fun balance of, it is a bit of a new frontier for buyers, for sommeliers, where it's, you know, producers they've only read about but never tasted, or regions they've never seen before in the U.S. So it is, there's this kind of excitement of discovering something new, but it's also a pretty easy sell to turn around to consumers, because it's grapes that people are familiar with. And as we talked about, kind of really approachable packaging. So I think it really, Australia right now is really the entire package. And I think, you know, the only downside we see is that it does have to travel around the world to get to us. And, you know, I'm not sure what other importers are doing, but we're, you know, offsetting our carbon emissions and making sure that we're, you know, we want this company to leave the world a better place than we found it.
I also think, you know, you're leaving something out. And I think that, you know, it's you guys that are representing and selling this. So I think you have the credibility and attention of the marketplace. You know, the first guest I ever had on the show was Laura Catena. And I think Laura Catena and her dad single-handedly made Malbec a brand because they traveled the world, they had the credibility, and they were tireless about it. And they were in Europe, they were in the U.S., and people are like, okay, Malbec, and they would really push it. Not the exact example, but with you guys out there, you know, representing it, pushing it, telling the story and the education, which is important, and I know important to you, you know, I think that's as important as anything, knowing that you're going to bring in, you know, good products. So, kudos to you on that.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Now, John, I just poured myself. Let's talk about Micro Wines, which is part of the Legend family. I just opened the Sinzo. Tell me a little about, take a few minutes to talk about this wine, talk about Micro, you know, where that's at and what you're doing.
Yeah, so Micro Wines is really just kind of a literal version of a micro negociant, because it's exactly what it is. It's purchasing fruit from different sources and vinifying it at a facility that I rent space at. You know, it started out with a Shiraz from Bannockburn in Geelong, which is a fairly cooler climate for Shiraz. It yields a wine that's in the low 13 percentile of alcohol and is a bit more savory, and had a really fun time with that. And I've three vintages of that have been produced, 18, 19, and 20. And then in 19, I added the Cinso and a collaborative Pinot Gris that I make with the person that I rent winemaking space from. And the Cinso comes from a biodynamic vineyard in an area called Vinevale in the Barossa Valley of South Australia. Vinevale is unique because it's all this really kind of white bleached sand over kind of more granitic and ironstone foundations. The vines are pretty kind of gnarly and old on that vineyard. They're really of all ages, ranging all the way to about 140 years old in some parts. I don't get any of that. There's no Cinso that's that old. This is, I think, around 50 to 70 years old.
That's pretty good, though.
You know, and Cinso is a grape that, this is kind of something that found me. The person that I work with, Sierra Reed, who's also in our portfolio, has been purchasing Grenache from this vineyard. And Cinso became available. So we the facility is in an area called Torquay, which is in Victoria. And what we do is we'll drive out to the Barossa, which is about 9 hours. We'll spend a night or two tasting and picking, and then drive the fruit back or follow the truck back and process it, which is always kind of a fun little road trip in the middle of harvest. You know, and micro wines is it's an interesting scenario. This year, I applied for an entrance exception into Australia because of COVID, and they wanted me to prove that my contribution to their economy was greater than the risk to the community that I would pose. And I wasn't able to do that, obviously. So, you know, for me, micro wines has been very much about learning through doing and getting a lot of aha moments. And, you know, I think back to, you know, it was really kind of working with Mac in the Yarra, where I said to myself, I never want harvest to go away. I want it to be a part of my life every year. It's a really fun, you know, enlivening moment in the year.
So because of micro, are you guys going to find yourself in Australia every year, minimally once a year,
you know,
for business, John for wine, you know, relationships, all of that logistics.
Totally. I mean, Australia is,
as my mom would say, it's a bit of a schlep.
My mother would say the same. It is Australia now holds a very special before legend. It was very special to us by the time we were leaving. And I think we always want to go back, see people, relationships, friends. And also, you know, there's a narrative that there's truth to the narrative. It's not just us saying, oh, there's this place that's untapped in the US. We're going to bring it back. And the narrative makes sense. We really fully believe in the merits of the wines and the place and the people, which is why we are doing this and want to go back. And, you know, I could definitely make, I could probably find some fruit and make a micro wines vintage 2021 in California, but that's not really what it's about.
Like Penfolds just did.
Exactly.
Yeah. Crazy.
So it is kind of in that sense. So it's really about me making the wine. I'm not farming. Maybe one day.
You said you're a negociant.
Right. So I got to look for the sources. I can't just pay someone to make it for me. So we're going to skip 2021.
You've checked a lot of the boxes of a sommelier, getting off the floor, making wine, becoming a wine business guy. I mean, you know, good for you. Good for you guys and all that. We got to wrap the show up. I told you that an hour would go pretty quickly. So, John, this is the 2020 Micro Wine Cinsault, C-I-N-S-A-U-L-T. It's from Vinevale in the Barossa Valley. John, I always wrestle. This kind of wine, which has nice acidity, it's crunchy, it's delicious, fruit, savory, everything. What's like the perfect pairing for this wine?
You know, I think that wine, it straddles quite a bit, but honestly, I think it's got a little bit of that kind of that green, crunchy, slight tannin. I feel like crudité is a lot of fun with that wine. Like just kind of something light and that's also a little bit herbaceous and crunchy and bright works really well.
I love it. Olives and
yeah.
It could hold up to that. I love it. It's a good wine.
Thank you.
All right, guys, we got to wrap up. I'm going to do a quick wrap up, and then I want to ask you a couple questions. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. But don't be lazy. Just subscribe because the show will show up every week after it's done. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation, on Instagram. We're at SBenRuby on Twitter. We're at BenRuby, but you could find us on either with the hashtag The Grape Nation. As I mentioned, I will post Jane and John's wines that we discussed, you know, with any detail. I asked you this earlier, guys, if people want more information on Legend, what's the best place for them to go?
Yeah, our website has a ton of stuff, legendaustralia.com. You know, we can reach out to either of us. It's jane@legendaustralia.com and John, J-O-N, @legendaustralia.com. And our DMs are open on Instagram, and we're available.
Yep. So get off your butt and talk to these guys if you want to talk to them about their wines. Now, you guys have personal websites, which shed a little insight into your life and the business. Jane, you're at Janie Maxine.
That is my, yeah, that's my Instagram. Yep.
Instagram. And John, I could never figure out, I thought I knew what DJ Grayman meant, but just while I have you, what is it?
So it's at DJ underscore Graminon. When Twitter and Instagram were coming out, we were trying to, remember we were hanging out one night at you know, in the cellar at EMP thinking about silly names. And I was kind of, it was my infatuation moment with the wines of Domaine Graminon. And I was like, this would be fun.
That's what I thought.
And it stuck.
Okay. You're stuck with it. All right, guys. I wish you only good luck. Don't let the business get in the way of your marriage. your partners in life and your partners in business. And at the end of the day, you got to be with each other. So good luck. Thank you to our guests, Jane Lopes and Jonathan Ross, their new import company, Legend Australia. Thank you to our engineer. Today we had Armin and everyone at Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam Ben Ruby, and you've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.